The following program was made possible by grants from the New Jersey Committee for the Humanities through the National Endowment for the Humanities and the New Jersey Historical Commission.
I am close to 40 years old, but I have lived more than 1,000 years during my life. When I was a little girl, I knew what it was to suffer.
Beginning in 1935, FDR's New Deal sent field workers across America to interview ordinary people, to build an oral history of the country. From 1939 to 41, these writers, hired by the Works Projects Administration, carried out an ethnic survey in New Jersey. The WPA writers spoke with immigrants, their children and grandchildren, the Irish, Poles, Lithuanians, Russians, Dutch, Ukrainians, Italians, and the Jews, mostly in the cities of Paterson and Newark. While there was no special focus on women in the survey, a vivid picture of women's lives emerges. About the old country, the writers heard nostalgia and disturbing memories. About men, devotion and derision. About children, fierce love and heartbreak. Within these narratives are echoes of the social problems we have only recently given names to, such as sexual harassment in the workplace and wage discrimination. The thunder of war echoes as well. Many women interviewed fled pogroms, anti-Jewish riots, that began in the 1880s, or the Russian Revolution, or World War I. Into this world of memories, the WPA field workers brought their pens and paper. Inevitably, like all interviewers, they became co-authors. Today, using actors, we recreate both sides of those conversations held more than 50 years ago. Now, part three of America, the Dream of My Life. America is a man's world, too.
During the war, we lived like dogs, running from one cellar to another, first to get away from the Cossacks and then the Polacks.
The Second World War has begun in Europe, but Jewish and Polish women interviewed by the WPA hold fresh memories of the First War. They had been trapped in a web of violence. In Eastern Europe, the Jews were caught in battle zones of nationalist aspiration involving the Poles, Lithuanians, Russians, and Ukrainians, all of whom were, in addition, playing out their centuries of hostility toward the Jews. Meanwhile, Polish nationalist aspirations were being crushed. Poland was being partitioned once more, the Russians again marching in from the east, the Germans from the west. A WPA field worker.
This woman must have been remarkably attractive at one time, because she can still make a man spin. She sang a few Jewish folk tunes at my request and had a rather pleasant voice.
My father and mother were both killed by soldiers who didn't like Jews. I was young, but I will never forget these things. My brother had to go and fight for the Tsar. My younger brother, we got out of the country and he came to America. He lives in Detroit now. My older brother, the one who was in the army, lives in Newark. My father was a blacksmith and made a pretty good living before the war came. All the farmers came to him with their horses.
Were you sent to school?
I went and learned to speak a very good Russian. I never knew how to speak Jewish until I came to America years later. I had a good voice when I was a child, and I used to sing for my family. My older brother had a very good voice, too, and we used to sing together. My father liked to hear me sing. He was very good to us. He was not an Orthodox Jew. My mother was very religious, and she taught me how to light candles and say prayers on Friday night. I always thought it was foolish. After she died, I never did it anyway.
What do you remember of the war?
I had a young cousin who was in the Tsar's army. He was killed during the beginning of the war, and my aunt, his mother, almost went crazy. She didn't live very long after this. our village saw armies marching through all the time, and all of them were hungry, took our last piece of bread. The German soldiers paid for what they took. They were good to us, and they didn't bother the women. The Polish soldiers used to steal from the Jews, and the women suffered from them. If you didn't want to give them something to eat, they would shoot you like a dog. There was no law when they came into a village. The Russian soldiers were not so bad at first, but later, when they began to lose, they were disgusted, and they didn't care what they did.
Did you come directly to America?
First, I went with my older brother to Poland, and we lived there for about 9 months. From there, we went to Germany, and there I met my husband. He was from Romania. We became good friends and went to America together. We lived at first in New York, where I married him. We were very good friends. In New York, we had a lot of friends after a while. We went to parties and to the theater with them. We only used to enjoy together. We lived in New York a few years, and then my husband got a job in Newark, and we moved here in the Clinton Hill section in a nice apartment. We fixed up the house, and we lived a good life together.
And today?
My husband and I are separated. We have been this way for 2 years now. I live here with my friends. I am used to it now, but at first I was almost crazy. You can get used to anything after a while. Even if you're not too much in love with a person, when you have lived together for 15 years, you get used to one another. I see my husband once in a while, but there is nothing there now.
In the late 1890s and early 1900s, there were more Polish women than men in Newark. Men were in demand by the women.
The men shortage this WPA field worker describes is a result of a particular immigration pattern. Many Polish women came to America alone to find work as domestics. When they'd saved a little money, often they sent for their sisters or cousins for whom work would also be available. Polish immigration began around 1880. By 1938, there were about 35,000 Poles in Newark, many of them single women working as servants in wealthy people's homes by day, and according to this brief account, searching for husbands in the evening.
The Polish women would seek their men in saloons and dance halls. They would meet a likable young man who they would call Greenie, and go as far as to propose to a man they thought was the one. Very often, the marriage was arranged, and the girl entrusted her savings to her future husband. It was not unseldom that the one would vanish with the money a few days before the marriage ceremony. One young man who had a girl's savings in his pocket was just about to have the marriage ceremony performed when he asked to be excused for a few minutes to get cigarettes. He never showed up again, and the girl is probably still waiting, I was told.
Mrs. J. entered America in 1913 at the age of 22. Her sister, who had married in America, financed the passage. Upon arriving in Newark, she lived with her sister until she received employment as a domestic in a Jewish household.
A WPA writer for the Ethnic Survey has visited a 50-year-old Polish woman in Newark, New Jersey.
She worked at this position 3 years, in which time she was able to repay her sister and managed to save some money for a rainy day. She had emigrated from a small suburb on the outskirts of Krakow in the Galician region, and was confused at the hustle and bustle of urban life in Newark. She admitted it was a pleasant type of confusion. In 1916, through an intermediary, she met a widower with four children, and after a brief courtship, married this man, who was about 15 years older than she. There was very little harmony in the household. In the second year of her marriage, she gave birth to a baby girl. After a bitter struggle lasting about 8 years, the woman gave up trying to live with her husband. She packed up, took her child, and fled to a domestic job in the city of Rochester, New York. During the second year of her new life as a domestic, Mrs. J fell in love with a Polish leather worker. She left her job and cohabited with him. The woman began to lead a satisfactory life. Their union was tied more firmly by the birth of a baby girl. They lived a pleasant existence for 9 years. Suddenly, the man became ill, and after a short illness, he died. As this was the woman's one real love affair, his death left her disillusioned with life.
Bitterness, disillusion. There's more than a hint of it in these life stories of women collected 50 years ago by the WPA Ethnic Survey. In the Great Depression, survival is the priority. For women, the social agenda of equality and fulfillment have been postponed, but the friction is there. Conflicts with bosses and husbands, sparks that will ignite decades later.
I was born in Newark on 11th Street. They tell me I was a very spoiled child. I always wanted my own way. I was very devoted to my father. I remember his taking me to the West Side Park, where he rolled me in the grass and played with me.
This young girl aroused my sympathy as nothing else ever has. She has the loveliest face I would ever hope to see. It is placed on a body that has been cruelly deformed around the back by a treacherous accident in her youth.
A WPA field worker, Newark, New Jersey, 1940, a neighborhood cafeteria. The young girl he interviews is 23 years old. Her parents emigrated from Lithuania.
I never wanted to go out with the family. I always wanted to stay home, and I used to insist that the family stay home, too. Even on Sunday night, the night they all liked to go out together.
Did your parents talk about the old country?
My father used to tell me stories of his childhood, his experiences when he worked in the forests of Lithuania. My grandfather, who was in the lumber business, owned a lot of territory, and my father worked for him. Oh, he used to tell wonderful stories of the forest. They were beautiful stories, and I never got tired of them. Then came the Depression. We lost our home in Irvington, which was very, very dear to me. My brother couldn't find a job in Newark, and he was very desperate, so finally he was offered a job in Texas, and he left us. I was the only child in the house. At a very early age, I realized my responsibilities, always worrying where we were going to get our next meal from. I had a girlfriend whose mother was very good to me. After school, she would invite me to her house for supper. She would talk to me and comfort me. We got to be great friends. I realized, too, that if I had supper there, it would save on food at home. And I used to go there sometimes, as much as 3 times a week.
Were you fond of school?
Not in the early grades, anyway. I loved gym. I was pretty much of a tomboy. I never turned down a dare, which was the beginning of the end for me. I went roller skating down a very steep hill one day and ran into a Mack truck. I never took another dare. I was never able to again. Not one that had to do with athletics. I injured my back, and after that I stopped taking gym. Everything I was most interested in, sports, athletics, playing with the kids, I had to give up. I went to all kinds of doctors. I ended up wearing a cast for 6 years. I was in the hospital for 6 months. I went through terrific agony and pain and torture and operations. I started high school, but I always felt that the kids were sneering at me because I looked bulky because of the huge cast. Finally, I discarded the cast, and that business was all over as far as my ailment was concerned. But it left its scars.
What did you do after high school?
I got a job in Bamberger's department store. I worked in the office for about 4 months. I didn't like my job a bit. I was in a constant state of upheaval. I was fired at the end of the Christmas season, and I was delighted. Then I got on WPA in the Department of Agriculture, but I was laid off the agricultural project after 8 months because of general reduction in forces. And then we were transferred to the police department. Some of the cops were pretty nice, others weren't. Most of them were wolves where the girls were concerned. They pinched us when the sergeant wasn't looking. The sergeant got a pinch in now and then too when the others weren't looking.
You don't work there now?
No. After a year and a half, I was transferred again to the planning project. I worked for the consultant director. He and I used to have very serious discussions on everything. He was the type of man who would advise young people because he thought it was for their benefit. Instead of encouraging me in my work, he would sit for hours and tell me what was wrong with it. The result was he broke down every bit of self-confidence that I had built up. When I first knew him, I had a lot of respect for him because of the education that he had and his prestige. When I have a lot of respect for people, I usually put them on a pedestal. Only he let me down tremendously. I was very upset over the possibility of losing my job. I was discussing this with him one day, and he told me that I really had nothing to fear. After all, I had a home, a mother and a father. We could always go on relief. Oh, after that, every idea I had about him was shattered. It has taught me how to get along with men.
I was born in the very heart of the Third Ward of Newark. My mother didn't like me to play with the other children. They were too rough. I turned out to be quite a tomboy. After my father had saved money from first sweeping floors in factories and then learning a trade, he decided to give in to my mother's lifelong wish of living where there were trees and flowers. We found a lot of land in Maplewood, New Jersey, which was mostly woodland, and laid plans for building a little home. Life continued more or less quietly until I was in the fourth year of high school, and then a new machine came out in the factory in which my father worked, which made it possible for any child to do his work. A young girl was hired at $12 for a job at which he had formerly been paid $75. The mortgage company took our house away. This was very hard on my mother, because for 10 years she had carefully and lovingly cultivated plants and flowers around the house. When we were children, we indulged in the sentimental pastime of buying my mother a plant every year at Mother's Day. When notice came to move, she asked if she could dig up these plants which her children had given her. They said no. It's part of the property as long as it's in the ground. And so my parents moved to an old deserted house on a dead-end street. After a 6-month search, I did finally get a job in a sewing factory at 88 West Market Street, making children's dresses for $6 a week. I was laid off there, got a job at Delpac on Central Avenue in Newark, making the flies on men's cotton pajamas at 2 cents a dozen.
This woman is very short and almost as large around as she was tall. Her features, however, were quite lovely. She has eyes that constantly express affection and sympathy. You might say that they were the eyes of one who has truly suffered.
A field worker for the WPA Ethnic Survey, Irvington, New Jersey, 1940. The interviewee was born in 1890 in Ukraine.
When I was 16, I went around with a young man. I think I was in love with him. I didn't know then what this meant. If I did, I think I would have stayed in Russia. He was very smart. He was a writer. I don't mean that his writing was printed. He used to write poetry. We read together from Pushkin. I would sing to him. Today, I sing in a Jewish choir here in Newark. I'm a contralto today. In Russia, when I was a young girl, I was a very good soprano.
Your father had sent you to school?
Yes. And when I was 18, I went to a dental school in Kiev. My older sister went too, but she didn't like it and stayed only a few months. I stayed for 2 years studying mechanical work. I learned to make teeth and plates. Not many girls were lucky enough to learn such a trade in Russia. The tools cost a fortune, and my father spent a lot of money to educate me. In school, I had a very good friend. We lived together. She was not as rich as me, and I helped her to buy many tools. Her family lived near Kiev, and we visited there many times. I met her brother, who was very quiet. I went out with him many times. Most of the time, I paid for both of us. I stayed in Kiev for a year after I finished school. I looked for a job, but I couldn't find one.
So you chose to come to America?
My friend and her brother wanted to go to America. I had read about America. We went together. My mother cried, but she let me go. I think my father's heart was broken, but he bought me a complete set of dental tools and hoped I would find work in America. He asked me if I loved my friend's brother. I told him no. He said I should not think about marriage until I learned to take care of myself. When we got to America, my friend met a businessman and they got married. I was alone and I married her brother. I cannot say I was too much in love, but we were both lonely and we thought it would be better to live together. We went to Cleveland and here my daughter was born. I almost died in childbirth. I was very sick for months. I could not nurse my baby, and she was not a very healthy child.
Did you find work as a dentist here?
I tried to, but I would not take a woman. America is a man's world too. I did some work for my neighbors. I made good teeth. We bought a machine. It cost $85. I never made enough to pay for it. My daughter was my whole life. I used to read to her in Russian. She did not understand me, but she always wanted to hear me read.
Then you moved again?
To Irvington, and my daughter had to transfer from Westside High School to Irvington High. She met a girl who was a model for photographers and painters, who made a lot of money for a young woman. Before I knew what had happened, my daughter was a model too. At first, she modeled without my knowing about it. Then one day, the father of the other girl came to my house in great anger and said to me that my daughter was leading his daughter from a good path, that my daughter had made his daughter into a model. I almost fainted when he showed me pictures of both of them naked. He told me that he followed them and found them both on High Street at a photographer's club modeling for a man naked. I chased him from my house. I was heartbroken. I begged my daughter to stop modeling, but she didn't want to stop. She said it was decent.
I had a nervous breakdown for almost a year. Even now, I am not so well. She works for WPA now. She gives us a few dollars a week. How much can she give with such a job? My hands are weak and I cannot do housework like I used to. I make a few teas once in a while, but I think this is a man's world. And even they are bitter too. My husband works day and night for a boss painter in Morristown. When he gets home at night, he is so tired sometimes, he doesn't eat, but reads a few minutes and goes right to sleep. I pity him. My daughter goes with a young man. He is a salesman for a cosmetic company. He doesn't make much, and they cannot get married. I wish they could. My daughter isn't getting younger. What more can I tell you?
More than the men's oral histories, these stories of women reveal heartache and frustration. Partly this reflects the unhealed wounds from violence in Europe and the hardships of the Depression, but only in part. For the women, something else was lurking. As one immigrant put it, America is a man's world too. They were feeling the pain of disillusion. America's promise was not being delivered to the hearts of immigrant women. Even the prosperity of World War II and the 1950s could not address this restlessness. A fundamental rethinking of roles was needed. It would come clear nearly three decades after the ethnic survey was completed, through the central revelation of the modern women's movement, that the personal is political. In time, this women's movement would give collective validation to the personal frustrations felt by these immigrant women, their daughters and granddaughters.
You have been listening to America is a Man's World Too, based on interviews of immigrants and their families conducted by the WPA Writers Project Ethnic Survey from 1939 to 41. The program was a co-production of the New Jersey Historical Commission and public radio station WBGO. It was narrated by Eli Wallach. The series is based on the book America, the Dream of My Life by David Stephen Cohen, published by Rutgers University Press, and was made possible by grants from the New Jersey Committee for the Humanities through the National Endowment for the Humanities and the New Jersey Historical Commission. The views expressed in it are not necessarily those of the Historical Commission, WBGO, or the New Jersey Committee for the Humanities. Advisors on the program, John Bodner, Gerald Hirsch, Barbara Kirshenblatt-Gimblett, and Virginia Yance-McLaughlin. Heard on today's broadcast, Deborah Allison, Eleanor Basescu, Ralph Fryer, John Layton, Earl Hammond, Jane Hunt, Rita Benor, and Luba Marshallow. The recording engineer was Leszek Wojcik, tape editor John Kalish, mixing engineer David Rapkin. The Unbroken Chain was directed by Charles Potter. It was written and produced by Marty Goldenson. The executive producer was David Stephen Cohen.